gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Tammy P. from Chatsworth, California. Let's give her a big welcome.
All set? Hi, everybody. My name is Tammy Pearsall, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous for a life in sobriety today. And you know, we come up here and we say these little, like, colloquialisms that are attached to us. And, you know, if there's anything I know, I always pray before I come up to a podium and speak. And I always say, God, please give me the words that I can help one person in this, I'm not going to say room today, I guess in this park today, even if it's me. And I truly think a God that I did not believe in and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for a life in sobriety, because I could not stop drinking alcohol. Can I see the hands of the people that are alcoholic? Good, I was getting a little scared there. And I'd like to welcome our new friends to Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you what they told me 15 years ago when I came crawling through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous after drinking away the only two things I had ever loved in my life, and that was my 4- and 5-year-old. The price I paid to continue to drink alcohol was I laid my 4- and 5-year-old down on the table, and I played a crap shot with their lives, and I lost. And when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous after losing custody of my 4-year-old son and my 5-year-old daughter, the old-timers told me, Tammy, you never have to drink alcohol again if you don't want to. And even if you do want to, we of Alcoholics Anonymous can absolutely show you a way of life that you never have to drink alcohol again. And I've come to understand that that's about the best promise you can give a drinking or a sober alcoholic, that you never, ever have to drink alcohol again. Really quickly, I'd like to thank Cheryl. I don't know where she's, somewhere around here. I'd like to thank Cheryl, there in the back, for asking me to come out and speak. And just to give you my quick AA stats, my sobriety date is 4/24/93. I have 15 years of sobriety. Thank you. My home group is a primary purpose group. We meet every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. In the San Fernando Valley on the corner of Corbin and Nordoff. And, Parthenian, right? Yeah, we moved, sorry. And I'd like to thank the three gentlemen that came with me today. All three of these men saw me come into Alcoholics Anonymous when I didn't have children and I had a broken heart, a broken home, broken children, and a broken spirit. And they told me in Alcoholics Anonymous to stick with the winners and win with the stickers. And I said, well, what's a sticker? And they said, those that stick with Alcoholics Anonymous. And my friend Don here will actually be celebrating, if he doesn't drink, in a couple weeks, 41 years of sobriety. And my friend Victor here has 36 years of sobriety. And my boyfriend, and we are a boy meets girl on AA campus, Patrick, and he has 27 years. So I drove up here with 103 years of sobriety. And that has served me really well, to stick with people who've walked this road before me. And not so much, they don't bark orders to me and tell me what to do, but they tell me to do what they do. And I said, well, how do I know what you do? And they say, well, go where we go. And I said, well, how do I know where you go? And they said, you'll know when you show. And like Don likes to always say, you know, the line that we heard the most wasn't sit down, shut up, and listen. It was get in, and they throw you in a car. And we did these all-day AA events, and today is just another one. We started at 7:30 a.m. this morning. And after this event, we're going to be going to yet another AA event, and that has also kept me in good stead for 15 years. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was living in a 4,000-square-foot home with 3 cars in the garage paid for, on a 1/2 acre land, and I had a full-time maid. But my husband and my kids were living in a 1-bedroom hotel room. Apparently, that's how bad my drinking had become for them. I had my first drink when I was 13. And after reading this big book called Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to understand that I had a strange and abnormal reaction to alcohol the very first time I ever drank it. But I didn't understand that at 13 years old because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. My version of an alcoholic, probably my whole life up until maybe even the first 3 months I spent in Alcoholics Anonymous, was a person that lived in a cardboard condominium down on Skid Row, and here I am, a surgeon's wife with a 5-bedroom house, and for some reason I thought that that kept me from being an alcoholic. as I look around the park tonight, not many of you look like what I thought an alcoholic was supposed to look like, though there are a few. And I've come to understand after reading this book and listening to the folks that walked before me that I absolutely am an alcoholic. I have a strange and abnormal reaction to alcohol. I will never not have that strange and normal reaction to alcohol. We don't hear this a lot in AA, but they told me that once you're a pickle, you will never again go back to being a cucumber. And I didn't understand that when I picked up my first drink when I was 13 years old. My dad was having a business party, and my dad used to have a lot of business parties, and yet he would always ship my sister and I out to friends and to neighbors and to relatives, and we were never able to participate. And this particular night, my dad looked at me, and I was 13, and my sister was exactly 1 year older than I was. She was 14, and he felt like maybe we were mature enough and old enough to be able to participate at his party. And I was so looking forward to this night. I didn't get a lot of attention from my father. He was one of those people that I could never get a stamp of approval, let alone even an acknowledgement. And I so wanted to please him this night. And I remember I had a little matching dress with my sister, and our hair was done up. And then these valet parkers came early, and they were setting up downstairs to do valet parking. And the whole house looked gorgeous and lit up, and there was all these hors d'oeuvres and trays with these little deviled eggs and chickens on skewers and all kinds of things, and the whole thing seemed so grown up. About a half an hour before the party started, this handsome guy walked through the door, and he had brown skin and a beautiful white tooth smile. He had a bow tie and a cummerbund, and he was the hired bartender. He went over to the bar, and he had all these bottles of champagne, and he's popping these bottles, and the steam is coming out the top. And he's got these long, tall, elegant glasses, and he's tipping them sideways and pouring the champagne into these glasses, and the bubbles were going from the bottom up to the top. And my God, the whole thing, it's like I grew up overnight and I'd arrived. I remember my sister sat up at the bar stool, and she and I were watching him, and he was entertaining us. And she said, "What does champagne taste like?" And he said, "Well, it's kind of sweet, it's kind of stingy." And I don't know about you, but that was that sister that never got the potential talk that I always got. Apparently, she and I both had potential, but she could see hers, and she knew how to access it, and she always did. Well, apparently, I had something called potential as well, and my parents and school teachers and about everybody throughout my childhood would always talk about my potential, and it's apparently something that everybody else could see, but I couldn't. But apparently, I had it. I just didn't know how to access it. And I remember always having a hard time with that older sister because she always did everything right. And so I used to enjoy playing a lot of one-upsmanship on her. And I remember when she asked this bartender what champagne tastes like, he said, "Why don't you try some?" So my 14-year-old sister took a champagne glass and she took a little sip and, oh, she sputtered the whole thing out. "That's terrible. That's awful. Well, here's my chance. See, I've already got an alky that knows where I'm going. So here's my chance to do one-upsmanship on that sister." So I remember taking the flute glass, and I just downed that sucker as quickly as I could. And my sister's eyes went open, and her jaw dropped, and the bartender's jaw dropped, and now I got an audience, so I downed two more quickly. And suffice to say, I ended up being put into that bedroom right when that party began, angrily, by that father that I had so wanted to please. And I remember that I was so sick, that first drunk, that my bed, you know when the bedroom or the rooms go like this, and I remember like being in a drunk and flashing in and out of a blackout that whole night, and I remember having to put my arm and my leg over the side of the bed to try to ground myself, and I puked my guts out. And that's not feminine, but that's my story. There has never been a time from the very first time I ingested beverage alcohol at age 13 until I came into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous at age 32, that I did not puke. I am a puking drunk from the get-go. And I wish I could tell you I vomit because it's a little more feminine, but I'm that, you know, chunk particles shooting across rooms or in your tie. And from that very first night, I see there's a few puking drunk women here, too. They're shaking their heads. I'm a puking drunk. But I didn't know what happened because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I ran away from that home at age 15 to make a very long, complicated story short. If you were a girl and you had a budding teenage body and you lived with my father, you weren't safe. Prior to the age of 15, I'd already been put in two foster homes because of the illicit nature of the relationship my father had with his teenage daughters. And at age 15, child services intervened through the schools again, and they came out and interviewed my family, and a court date was set, and I was to be put into yet another foster home until the court date could be arranged. And my sister had run away from home a year earlier when she was 15. So I'm 15 for the first time in my life, and I'm faced going into a foster home without my sister, and I didn't want to go. So I ran away from home and moved in with my sister, who had already ran away from home a year earlier. And she and I shared this tiny little studio apartment, and that lasted all of about 3 months. She's 16, I'm 15, and that was certainly like the blind leading the blind. And then I lived the way most 15-year-old runaway girls live. I was young, I was fun, I was cute, I was worldly, and I was willing. And sadly to say, there were a whole lot of you older men that were willing to take me in and allow me to pay that price. I want to mention this now. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been put in four lockdown units, but never once were they for the diagnosis of alcoholism. They used to pick me up as a 15-year-old runaway, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, and I'd be in all kinds of chaos, and the police would come out, and they'd put me in these lockdown units, never once for the diagnosis of alcoholism. It was always mental and emotional trauma due to childhood, mental and emotional disorders due to my childhood, bulimia, anorexia, bipolar disease. I had every diagnosis in the book prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd been in four lockdown units, but never once were they for the diagnosis of alcoholism. So I'm a 15-year-old runaway, and I'm living with all these older men. And I would kind of always just take on the personality of whatever guy I was living with. I had no principles that ruled my life. I stood behind nothing. And it's like, if you said left, I'd go left. And if you said right, I'd go right. And it is as sadly true today as it was back when I was a kid coming up through school in the 1960s. I'm a school teacher today. I'm a sixth grade school teacher. I teach English out in the San Fernando Valley at a public school where we live. And if you are not a semi-decent looking little kid, and or if you do not have some athletic ability, and or if you do not have some academic ability, if you do not have one of those three components, looks, sports ability, or being intellectual, school is a really, really miserable place to survive. And I look at a lot of the little guys and girls that I teach, and they struggle just to get through a day of middle school sometimes because they don't have one of those three components. Well, back before I ran away from home, even though I had all these atrocities going on at home with my dad and being put in and out of foster homes, I was a good-looking little kid, and I was a really, really good athlete. In fact, I was such a good athlete that they allowed me to play and practice with boys' teams after school before there was such thing as co-ed teams. And I was really strong academically, so I was very popular with my teachers. So I kind of learned this double life growing up as a kid. I was kind of academic, popular, athletic Tammy by day, and at school I thrived and did really, really well. And I was always scared, chaotic, runaway, out-of-control Tammy with my family, so I kind of had this double life. Well, now I'm a 15-year-old runaway, and I'm living with older men. The first man I actually lived with for about 8 months when I ran away from home at 15, he was 42 years old. And I remember one day we went into the post office. Now, I've dropped out of high school. I'm 15 years old. And we walked into the post office, and there was a poster advertising the GED exam. And for those of you that aren't familiar, the GED exam is a graduation equivalency diploma where you can take a test, and if you pass it, it's equivalent to having a high school diploma. And I dropped out of high school 6 months into the 10th grade to live with this older man and run away from home. So he turns to me and he says, you know, Tammy, you're actually pretty smart. You should take that test and at least get your high school diploma. And again, I have no principles or any original thoughts whatsoever on my own, and I do whatever, you know, the flavor of the month guy wants me to do, so I'm like, okay. So I just grabbed the form and I filled it out more or less to just kind of appease him. I went and took the test 6 weeks later, and I found out about 3 weeks after that that I had passed the test. I would say 2 or 3 days after I got the news that I passed the test, I got a call from the Daily News out where I live in the San Fernando Valley. And a girl who worked for the Daily News, which is a local newspaper, wanted to come out and interview me because they were going to do an editorial on what a 16-year-old high school dropout was going to do with the GED exam. And from what I understand, the GED exam has been around since the end of World, or just after World War II, but I believe they had just lowered the age to take it from 18 to 16. And what I do know is I was the first person in the state of California to pass it. I think I was just 1 week short of my 16th birthday, or I had just turned 16 by the time I got the results. So this girl wants to come out to my apartment, and I'm living with a 42-year-old man, and we have, like, beads and a strobe light and patchouli oil and incense, and I said, sure. And she comes out, and there I am with my 42-year-old boyfriend and my little cut-off shorts and my wild, crazy self. And she walks in, and, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, these crusty old-timers used to tell me, you know, kid, you don't have a bad little message, but it's kind of hard to decipher with all the F-words and all the cussing that you use. And I used to think, well, what the F does that have to do with my sobriety, you know? And they used to tell me, you know, I used to wear tube tops and high-cut shorts and pretty provocative outfits, skipping around here, flirting with you men, because I needed that attention so badly. And I remember them asking me that I might want to look at how I'm dressing, you know, at mixed meetings. I'm learning how to respect the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd sit with my tube tops and my cussing language and say, well, what the F does that have to do with my sobriety? But as I look back over my story, when that girl came out to interview me, here I am, a 15-year-old runaway. I think I've just now turned 16 years old. And she comes to my apartment, and she was a college graduate, and this was her first job as a journalism major working for a newspaper. And she walked in the room, and she was wearing a little business suit, and she was one of those debutante college graduate girls that I know would have nothing to do with a pass-around uneducated tart like me. And the girl had on no makeup, and she was beautiful. And, in fact, I have a 21-year-old daughter right now that's in her third year at UCLA. And she reminds me a lot of what my daughter looks like now. You know, she doesn't have to dress provocatively. She doesn't wear makeup. She's beautiful. But what really impressed me was that this girl literally took an interest in me. And she said, Tammy, you must be pretty smart to pass the GED exam, you know, when you were only 15 and a half years old. And are you going to go on to community college? Now, I don't come from college-educated kind of folk. My parents are not parents where you sit down and we're talking about college. So I said, well, what's junior college? And she explained to me what a junior college was. And she told me that I could go down to a junior college and where it was and that I could start signing up for classes now that I have my high school diploma or an equivalency, and I could take classes for $32 a unit. And she stayed in contact with me and helped me. And I was so impressed that this pretty college-educated girl that was maybe only, you know, 9 or 10 years older than me took an interest in me, that I actually signed up for community college because of her, because I wanted to please her. And now I understand why these crusty old-timers told me, you know, Tammy, when you're at a podium at Alcoholics Anonymous, wear a dress. Act like a lady. You don't need to be up there throwing out F-words and cussing and trying to impress everybody with your badness. And I didn't understand that when I came in, but I understand that today. And I see girls come into my home group with their little tube tops and their high-cut shorts flirting around with the men, and every other word up on the podium is an F-word. And I'll walk up, and I tell them, welcome. And what can I do to help you with your sobriety? And I pass down the same message that these old-timers passed down to me, because I understand that today. In fact, I'd like to thank my friend Don Crandall, because I'm sitting here with 2.5-inch heels in a park, and every time I keep walking across the grass, I'm going down about 2.5 inches into the grass. So even at 15 years old, I'm always looking for an edge or a loophole, and I said, you know, Don, I'm going to be at this park for probably about 4 or 5 hours today. Can't I at least bring, like, a change of clothes for after I'm done speaking or before I speak? And, you know, that good old-timer, I don't think so, answer came along. And so I'm quite comfortable in my 2.5-inch heels all day here for 5 hours, but I understand. Anyway, I went off to Pierce College, which was this local community college, and when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hear men and women get on this podium also playing one-upsmanship, and they'd say stuff like how many years they'd been locked in the penitentiary or how many jails they'd been to or I haven't had a sober breath for the last 10 years. And I'd sit in the back of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, then I must not be an alcoholic. Because I don't know about you, but I'm one of those people that I can swear off alcohol. For me, it is with a solemn oath. And I didn't understand that. So when I came into AA and people said that they drank every single day 24/7 for the last 10 years, I didn't think that I belonged until these old-timers got my nose in this book. And in this book, it tells us that we have brief intervals of recovery, that we can swear off alcohol. Our problem is that we cannot stay stopped. So when I signed up to Pierce College, I don't know what your swearing off periods look like, but this is what mine looks like. Usually I come out of a blackout and probably a good long 3-month drinking binge where things are just really going bad. And I wake up one morning and I get all the alcohol in my house and I throw it all out in the dumpster behind wherever it is I'm living with a solemn oath that I'm never going to drink again. Then I usually shower and shave my legs and condition my hair. Then I'll floss my teeth, brush my teeth. Then I go down to the local health food store and drop about $100 on health food stores. Now, I've been living on a diet of alcohol for 3 months, but now I'm going to eat brown rice and yogurt for breakfast. Then I join the local gym, and I'm going to now, you know, train and be an athletic trainer and lift weights. And then I sign up for college, and I take 17 units. And I'm telling you, when I went to that local, that community college, I did a swearing off, and I'm at Mrs. Gooch's back then was a local health food store, and I'm eating brown rice and yogurt for breakfast, and I'm taking 17 units, and I'm working out every day at the gym, and I'm running 10K races, and I'm studying, and I'm making straight A's, and I was on the dean's list every single semester for the 4 semesters that I was at Pierce College. And at 18 years old, I now had 2 years of college under my belt, 17 units a semester, straight A's, and I'm on the dean's list all 4 semesters. And that entitled me to get what was called the Chancellor's Award. And the Chancellor's Award is where a few department heads at the local university pick a few students that demonstrated academic excellence. And I also played for their tennis team. And that Chancellor's Award entitled me to go to any state college in the state of California from San Diego all the way up north for the next 2 years so that I could finish my college education and get a bachelor's degree. And they were going to pay my tuition, my housing, my textbooks, and give me money to live on. And guess what I did, guys? I quit. Because I was in a swearing-off period. And at some deep inherent level, even though I had not read about the mental obsession of alcoholism in this book, that we arrange our lives so that we can have periods of drinking. But I didn't understand that back then because I hadn't read this book and I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I intuitively knew at 18 years old that there was no way I could go another 2 years swearing off alcohol and being intense and crazy the way I was that 2 years. So to hell with it, I quit. And that's the mental obsession that they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Many of us women, we love losing custody of our children when we're drinking. We say we don't like it, but then we don't have to be responsible. I know a lot of women that I work with, and they do not have custody of their kids and how much they hate it and this, this, and that. But when you look back over their stories, mine included, because I'm one of them, I wanted to lose that responsibility because it gave me an opportunity to drink with impunity. But I didn't understand that before I read the book. So now I dropped out of school one more time. I'm 18 years old, and I spent the next 2 years working on what I do best, which is bad relationships and drinking. And I'm living with all these older, crazy men again. And I'm living in an apartment complex in Encino, out where I live. And there's one wall that separates me and this guy next door named Rick. And I'm living with an older boyfriend, and I'm drinking, and I'm having all kinds of problems. And then I get into my swearing off period again. And now I'm 18 years old, and this time I swear off, and I sign up at a local 4-year university, and I'm taking 17 units and eating brown rice and yogurt for breakfast, and I'm jogging, and I'm working out, and I'm living with this older guy, and my next-door neighbor was an obstetrician. He delivered babies for a living, and he took a real interest in me, but the poor old guy Rick didn't know that he had met me during a swearing-off period. So one more time, this guy meets me, and I'm studious, academic, athletic Tammy by day, and he's really impressed. And we start to develop a relationship, and we start running 10Ks together, and I'm going to school, and this time now I decide I'm going to go to med school, so I'm taking microbiology and physiology, and these are courses that he had taken when he was in medical school, so he took an interest in me, and he would help me with my homework, and like all my swearing-off periods, there was a brief interval of recovery when this guy met me, followed always by a worse relapse. And then I start drinking again. And this guy who had really taken a liking to me, all of a sudden I'm very confusing to him because he hears these knockdown, drag-out, drunken fights that I'm having with my boyfriend, and my fights aren't pretty. I'll pull out your hair and slap you, and the scratching and the yelling and screaming. And the guy that I, this next-door neighbor guy that I had met, Rick, was the one that would always call the cops when I'd get in my drunken fights. And I remember one night in particular, I'm with my boyfriend, and he comes home from work, and we do shooters of tequila, and we get in one of those knockdown, drag-out fights. And that neighbor, Rick, that had become a friend of mine the 6 months prior, calls the cops, and the cops show up at the door, and the boyfriend gets rid of the cops, and that neighbor, Rick, is standing behind the cops going, "Oh, my God, is Tammy okay? Is Tammy okay?" And we got rid of Rick, and we got rid of the cops. And then we do those all-night makeups, you know, the way we know how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our relationships are so goofy. It's like we beat the crap out of each other at 9 o'clock at night, slapping and kicking and "I hate you" and yada, yada. Then the cops show up, we get rid of them, and then it's those all-night passionate makeups, you know, the way we know how to do, "Oh, baby, don't ever leave me. You're my soulmate." And we spent all night, you know, making up the way we know how to do. And I woke up the next morning and did exactly what they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That after a while, a drinking alcoholic can no longer separate the true from the false. That after a while, the only life a drinking alcoholic comes to understand is a drinking life. And I thought nothing of waking up the next morning, taking a little liquid makeup, covering up the black eyes, the bruises, and the choke marks that I'd received the night before, throwing a backpack on my back, and going off to my local four-year university like there is absolutely nothing wrong with this picture. I spent, you know, the next 5 hours in school that day, and I come home in the afternoon. Now, I'd been beaten up the night before. I was drunk the night before. I didn't get any sleep because I had to make up with the boyfriend all night. Now, I've spent all day long sitting in classes, and all I want to do is get up to my apartment and get that liquid relief that I know is on the way. And if you can identify with this part of my story, you're probably an alcoholic. I am in the underground parking, walking toward the elevator. I have not seen the vodka, I have not tasted it, and I have not smelled it. But I know that once I push that elevator door button and I get in, I only have to go up 3 flights and open the very first door in the hall, and I know right where that vodka is in the counter, and I am already feeling relief. I already feel that sense of lightheadedness and that ease and that comfort produced by that drink alcohol, and I haven't even swallowed it. That's the power that alcohol has on me. So I'm walking toward that elevator, and all of a sudden that next door neighbor, Rick, you know, that called the cops the night before is going, "Wait, Tammy, hold the elevator." And now the last damn thing I want to do is get stuck in that elevator with that neighbor that called the cops the night before, and I have no liquid confidence in me. And so I'm pushing the closed door button, and the next thing I know, his hand wedges between the doors just in time, and it opens up, and I'm stuck in the elevator with that guy, Rick, my neighbor, with no liquid confidence whatsoever. And, you know, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to use a tremendous amount of sexually inappropriate behavior or gestures or a whole lot of tough girl cussing to kind of back you off of me, to get you on the defense, because I never wanted you to really just look me in the eye and see what a damaged, scared, you know, pained person I was. So I remember Rick got in the elevator and he says, "Tammy, can I ask you a question?" And first I tried to do this seductive Tammy, like, "Yeah, Rick, what's up?" And he just took me and he held me away and he said, "No." And he said, "I really need to talk to you." So then I do the cussing tough girl act, you know, "Yeah, well, what the F is up?" And he took my chin and he held it. And he pulled it up like this so that I couldn't wiggle away. And he looked right down into my eyes with those beautiful brown eyes of his. And he said, "My God, Tammy, what is it about you that makes you feel that you deserve to live the life you're living like this?" And for whatever reason, and today I know it's the grace of God, I got off that elevator and I went into Rick's apartment. And I didn't do the seductive sexual Tammy act. And I didn't do the little tough girl whatever. I just went in and I talked to him like a broken little girl. And I told him about my dad, and I told him about the foster homes, and I told him about all the stuff that went on as a kid. And I told him the cry of every drinking alcoholic, "One day I'm going to finish my education, and one day I'm going to get a job, and one day I'll have my own apartment, and one day I won't live with these abusive men like my dad, and one day and one day and one day." Because the cry of every drinking alcoholic is, "I know my life is insane, but one day, like my train, it's just going to come in, boom, it's just all going to be okay." And do you know, I truly believed that. I truly believed just one day I was going to wake up and the story was going to change. And sadly to say, it never did until Alcoholics Anonymous intervened. But I didn't understand that back then because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. So I tell him my story, and I broke down like a little girl and just sobbed. And he held me. And I remember he held me for a long time. No sexual provocativity on my part, no cussing, no tough girl act. I was just a broken human being. And I went to my own apartment that night right next door. And I do remember I didn't drink that night. But the next morning I woke up, and I felt that fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. That fear that comes in 100 different forms. That fear that this book tells us affects our actions and our behaviors. And I didn't know what to do because I realized that that neighbor saw what a broken human being I was and that I had to look at him every day. So I did what any good alky does. When they feel the fear that they talk about in this book, I developed a plan. Like my friend Don says, wasn't a good plan, but I had a plan. And I actually left my boyfriend that I was living with that day, moved in with Rick, the next-door neighbor, and I married him 3 weeks later because I had to control him. He saw my pain, and my ego was so big, and I needed so badly to be the actor and the director of my own drama that I couldn't stand that this man really saw the truth about me for a split second. I couldn't tolerate that. So I had to maneuver and manipulate myself into that environment and change his perception of me, which was like a joke, but I thought I could. Sadly to say, he married me 3 weeks later as well, and that's when he qualified for Al-Anon. And I'm not going to go into all the devastating things that happened the next 7 years of that marriage. But what I will tell you, ladies and you men, I spent the next 7 years punishing Rick for everything that my father or any man out on the streets had done to me. And because he had not yet attended a program of recovery called Al-Anon, at that time, he sadly took the punishment. And for 7 years, I did everything that I possibly could to destroy his soul. But that marriage produced two children, and today I have a daughter, Chelsea, that's 21, and I have a son, Alex, that's 20. And through the grace of God, when I was pregnant with both my children, I was so physically sick, I had a condition where I couldn't keep any food down at all. I could barely eat. I only gained like 11 pounds, I think, with my son, and about the same with my daughter. I was really sick throughout the pregnancy, and I couldn't stand the smell of perfume. I couldn't stand the smell of coffee, and for whatever reason, I could not stand the smell of alcohol. So I became pregnant with my daughter, and for 9 months, I did not pick up a drink. 6 weeks after I gave birth to my daughter, I found out I was pregnant again, this time with my son. And I went another 9 months straight without picking up a drink. But 4 weeks after I gave birth to my son, I walked into their little room. They shared a room, and my daughter was in a day bed, and my son was in a crib. And I walked into the room, and it's like I woke up out of a dream and realized that somewhere in the last, 2 years, I had brought two human living beings into the world, and these two little kids were looking at me for something, and I had absolutely nothing to give. I was a completely dependent human being. And it was like I felt that fear that they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And one more time, I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel this fear. And they don't have a God that they can pray to and ask for strength. And they don't have friends like these that they can hit at a meeting or call up on the phone and talk those dumb fears through with. And I went down to the liquor store, I bought a huge bottle of vodka, and I started drinking around the clock. To give you some idea of the way I drank alcohol, I would wake up every single morning, and I'd go straight to my bathroom, and underneath the cabinet, I would keep a bottle of really cheap vodka, like the gallon jug. And then I'd lock my bathroom door, and I'd take my long blonde hair, I used to have really long blonde hair, and I'd wrap it all up because I'm a puking drunk, and the barf particles that bounce off the toilet water would get into my hair. So I would wrap up my hair, and I'd put it in a shower cap. Then I'd take a toothbrush with toothpaste, and I'd put the toothpaste on the toothbrush, and I'd lay that down on the counter. Then I would plug my nose, and I'd uncap the bottle or unscrew it. It was like a screw bottle. And I'd down as much vodka as I could. Then I'd recap the bottle because, God forbid, I would smell the fumes, and it would make me puke before it stayed down long enough to take effect. Then I'd take the toothbrush with the toothpaste, and I'd brush my teeth, and I'd brush my tongue, because God forbid I tasted the vodka before it stayed down long enough to take effect. Then I would slowly release my fingers and pray that that vodka would just heat up my whole chest and give me that goofy, drunken feeling in my head. And then I'd turn around and throw the whole thing up every single morning. And I'd hear a knock on the door. And it was my two and three-year-old. Mommy, Mommy, are you done throwing up again? Because they knew Mom's morning ritual. And if that isn't insane, I don't know what is. And to give you some idea of the effect that alcohol had on me, I went down to alcohol very quickly, and they talk about that in the book with regards to women, that we cross like all reasonableness in a very short period of time, and that certainly happened to me. I got to the point where when I first started drinking, it was for fun. Very quickly, I started to drink just to feel normal, and very shortly after that, I was drinking just not to feel. And I got to that stage pretty quickly. And I remember that my husband would wake up and there'd be broken glass and all this craziness that I'd do in a blackout. So he got this brilliant idea to leave me at home with a full-time housekeeper so I didn't get the keys to the car or kill myself. And he had our kids taken out to full-time daycare. So he delivers babies all night long. He's an obstetrician. He sees office patients all day. I have a full-time outside service taking care of my two small children. I have a full-time maid staying home taking care of me. I have a whole lot of money and a whole lot of free time, and that's suicide for an alcoholic. And one day he picked up the kids after daycare, and he's driving toward the house, and somehow in a blackout, I've gotten myself on the roof of our two-story house where we live in, and he pulls up to the house with our 2 and 3-year-old in the car, and there's Mom, like, on the roof, you know, wild and drunk. And he parked the car in the garage, and he walked out of the garage, and my 2 and 3-year-old were on either side of him, and he just looked up at the roof with Mom up there, and I literally just jumped off the roof onto his back. I started digging my nails into his head. He's, like, spinning around with me on his head. My 2 and 3-year-old are screaming. All the neighbors are coming out. And he reached up to grab me to get me off of him, and his fist knocked me really, really hard in the side of the eye and gave me, like, a big hematoma and a black eye. And I waited till the next morning to sober up, and I went into the local police station out where I live in the San Fernando Valley the next day, and I filed felony battery charges on my husband for something he didn't even do. Those detectives walked into his office where he had been seeing his female patients. Remember, he's an obstetrician. He delivers babies. They walked into his office on a Monday morning in front of his patients and his staff, and they slapped handcuffs on him, and they took him off to jail for felony battery charges. And that's the only sober parent that Chelsea and Alex had. That's what I do when I drink alcohol, folks. That's the effect that alcohol has on me. I know we're not a glum lot, and we're supposed to have all this fun in the fellowship, but I'll tell you, I'm really glad that these three old-timers cared more about my life than they did about my feelings, and these old boys have been real rough on me for the last 15 years. In fact, I got hell in the car all the way down here. But you know what? Your very life is at stake here. Your life is at stake, and sadly to say, for many of you, your children's lives and your family's lives are at stake, too. This isn't all fun and games here. This is a life and death proposition for you if you're an alcoholic. And thank God that the old timers that found me took this deal really seriously. And believe me, we still have a lot of fun. Anyway, it was very shortly after my husband spent that night in jail for felony battery charges that he found this horrible group of people called Al-Anon. And I am an alcoholic that is deeply, deeply indebted and supportive of Al-Anon. Because Al-Anon took away my greatest enabler, and they gave me a husband, and they gave my children a father. But God, I hated those Al-Anons while I was drinking. So he starts attending these Al-Anon meetings, and, you know, girls, you may identify this more than you men, but I'm the type of woman that when I can finally trap and ensnare a man, I know deep inside, I've always known what a raw deal I am. So what I do is I first grab and trap you and snare you, usually with some type of, like, sexual thing, because that's really all I ever had to offer. Then once I get you, I do the Tammy self-promotion campaign where I tell you how wonderful I am all the time and make sure that you're infiltrated with that. Then I make sure that I isolate you so that you can never really get out in the world and see that there's some really decent, well-educated, feminine, kind, non-manipulative women out there, because if you're exposed to someone like that, deep inside, I know what a raw deal you'd have with me. And so when my husband started attending those Al-Anon meetings, I knew that he was going to finally figure out the truth, and I think I called them the Let's All Feel Sorry for Dr. Rick Harem meetings, because it was like him and all these women feeling sorry for him. And I couldn't tolerate that. And I started to drink like a vengeance, because deep inside, I believe that we do know the truth about us. We're constitutionally incapable. The book tells us that. Someone read it today. Those who do not recover, if you're one of those in-and-outers or you're one of those slippers, the book tells you why. The girls I work with say, Tammy, why did I drink again? The book tells you exactly why. Because you're constitutionally incapable of being honest with yourself. And when I came into AA, I was constitutionally incapable of being able to stand up here and tell you, I know I'm a loser. I know I'm full of crap. I know I'm a manipulator. I know I'm a game player. Fortunately, these guys were constitutionally very capable of telling me the truth, whether I wanted it or not. So anyway, he starts attending these meetings, and I'm drinking with a vengeance now because I'm losing, and I know I'm losing, and I know those Al-Anons are giving him the strength he needs to stand up to the insanity of my alcoholism. And I remember one day he came home, and he looked me in the eye after attending those Al-Anon meetings for a couple of months, and he said, Tammy, you can go to a hell in a handbasket if you want to, but you are no longer going to take Chelsea and Alex and I with you. And I saw something in my husband's eyes that night, and I knew that those Al-Anons were giving him the strength he needed. And one more time, I felt the fear they talk about in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And one more time, I did the only thing an alcoholic knows how to do when they feel that fear, and they don't have a God to pray to for strength or friends to come and talk those fears through with. And I got in my car, and I went down to the liquor store. I bought a huge bottle of vodka. I puked the whole thing up in a brown paper bag. I got out on the freeway out where I live in Chatsworth. And on the freeway, the alcohol started to take effect. I remember seeing a call box and in my drunken stupor thinking, hey, I'm going to make a phone call. And the next thing I know, I plowed my car right into that call box. Steam is shooting out. And now I'm standing 30 days later in front of another woman judge. I always thought those women judges with like five kids, they always thought a lot of me being a mother drinking the way I did. And this woman judge is looking at my rap sheet, and she said, you know, Tammy, your rich doctor husband isn't going to buy you out of this one, and you're going to do some time. However, I will waive 30 days of a jail sentence if you are willing to go into a lockdown unit. Now, like I mentioned earlier, I'd already been in four lockdown units from the age of 5 to 15 to 31 for mental and emotional disorders, trauma due to childhood, post-traumatic stress syndrome, bipolar disorder, bulimia, and anorexia. So I figured, heck, I've already been in four of them. I might as well go in another. And I leave and I go down to this lockdown unit and I tell those doctors what I've been telling them the first time I started appearing in those places when I was 15 years old. Look, it seems like every time I end up in trouble, it's because I drink alcohol and then I black out and these crazy things happen. And they told me back what they've been telling me since I was 15 years old. Tammy, you have severe trauma because of your childhood, and you are given alcohol by men that have no idea of the father you had and the trauma that you've been through as a kid, and none of this is your fault. Later when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a buck in a basket, you suggested I may be an alcoholic. In that lockdown unit, I used to tell those doctors that I'd wake up out of a blackout every morning, go downstairs and see broken glass, a broken children, a broken husband, and a broken home. I'd go right back up the stairs, turn the heating blanket on to Mom, suck my thumb, and think of ways to take my own life and kill myself because I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I'm doing this crazy stuff. I think I'm nuts. And in that lockdown unit, they told me that I had clinical depression as a result of my childhood, and about the best hope they had for me was medical management through psychotropic drugs, and they could certainly get me some SSI and some free money because of this diagnosis, but none of this was my fault. Later when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, these crusty old-timers had a new name for a mother of two children that was willing to try to commit suicide and make high, big, dramatic scenes about it without giving a flying crap how it affected those two children. They called it alcoholism, selfishness, and self-centeredness. The world always revolves around me, my pain, and my drama. In that lockdown unit, I told those doctors that I used to take money out of my husband's wallet, and on my swearing-off periods when I joined local gyms, I'd go to the local gym, work out all morning while he's busting his ass delivering babies, go up to the pub at my gym after, buy everybody lunch on his dime, always playing the big shot, always taking credit for money I didn't earn or taking credit for things I didn't do. And in that lockdown unit, they told me that my taking my husband's money was really my way indirectly of trying to buy back that self-esteem that I'd been so poorly robbed of in that childhood, but none of this was my fault. Later when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, these old-timers had a really fancy name for that. They called it stealing. Not only did I steal my husband's money and take other men out and play the big shot and always buy people lunch on his dime, I didn't even know how to work, but I sure took credit for the work that other people did. But on several occasions, as a wife and a mother of two small children, I took some men to some pretty seedy hotels, and I did what women do with those men in those seedy hotels. And in that lockdown unit, they told me that really deep inside, I was just acting out and searching for the love of that father that I never received in that childhood, and that my needs weren't getting met at home by my husband, Rick. But none of this was my fault. Later, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers had a name for that, too. They called it cheating. By the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother and my husband had literally paid over $100,000 in expensive psychotherapy to find out that living inside of me was this damaged, wounded child, and I was just a victim of the atrocities of my childhood. And for a buck in a basket, these old crows said, no, baby, you're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a thief, and you're an alcoholic suffering from alcoholism. And it is the first time I heard the truth about me in 31 years. Young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't like the old timers, don't worry about it. You'll never be one. Because they know what the heck they're talking about. I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself, and I could not thoroughly and completely give myself to this simple program. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Not, I'm going to come in for a while, get a couple months sober, get a job, get a busy little life, and then somehow squeeze in a little time for some AA meetings. You do not schedule your AA meetings around your busy little life. You schedule your recovery, and everything else falls into place. And I've heard that from the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous when I surrendered my right to drink alcohol. So I start coming to AA meetings after I get out of that lockdown unit, and I'm wearing low-cut tops, high-cut shorts, and I spent most of my time in the parking lot flirting with you men. And I first came in, and I told them that, you know, my problem isn't alcohol. My problem is really me. And the old-timer said, baby, if your problem is you, go back to therapy. If your problem is alcohol, come to us. Then I started flitting around with you men in the parking lot. And the old-timer said, baby, if you came here for the men, there's the door. If you came here for sobriety, here we are. And they just kept giving me the straight AA message. And what is the AA message? The AA message is a message of hope to a drinking alcoholic that you never have to drink alcohol again. So I start coming to your meetings, and I wear my low-cut tops, my high-cut shorts. I come to meetings late. I leave meetings early. I watch all of you clean up, and I assume, isn't it great that these people always have some place to provide for me to come to? And needless to say, I took five of those 30-day trips. But I'll never forget my last chip. Oh, and by the way, if you're one of those obnoxious newcomers that has like five 30-day chips on your belt buckle and you're parading it around like this is something to be proud of, I was one of those too. I took my fifth 30-day chip and I attached it to my belt buckle with the other four that I had received the four 30 days prior to that. And I went out in the parking lot to flit around with you men. But I forgot to mention from the podium when I took my fifth 30-day chip that I had not seen my own children in 67 days. Because Al-Anon and my husband, Al-Anon had rightly convinced my husband to get those two kids away from this drunken mother who was in and out of AA, in and out of rehab, in and out of therapy, and absolutely refuses to do what she needs to do to get help. And that he is the only sober parent those two children have, and he needs to make the sober decision to get those kids away from their insane mother. And my husband and kids were living in a one-bedroom hotel room. And I took my fifth 30-day chip and went back out in the parking lot to flirt with you men and this mean old timer, Cowboy Nick, down where I got sober. The homeless guy came out and he said, kid, you have a phone call. And I walked into that clubhouse and I picked up the phone and it was my husband, Rick, who I had not talked to in over 2 months. And he said, Tammy, are you sober? And with the arrogance of an alcoholic, I said, yes, Rick, I'm sober. In fact, I've just taken another 30-day chip. And he said, well, Tammy, if you're sober, our five-year-old son signed up for T-ball. And the kids really miss you. And if you're sober, Tammy, we'd like to invite you to Alex's game. And I got the directions, and I drove out to that little league field. And I parked my car, and all of a sudden I start walking toward the mound, and I look up, and there's my little five-year-old son, Alex, who I have not seen in 2.5 months, or 2 months and a week. And he's wearing this, like, little uniform, and he's got these little cleats that are, like, this big. And he's got a helmet, and he's trying to hit a ball off this big orange cone. And he's so little, my son, that every time he swings at the cone and the ball, the helmet falls down over his eyes. And my little six-year-old daughter, Chelsea, was standing at the chain-link fence in a sundress, eating this, like, little rainbow snow cone, and her hair was, like, all wild because her dad didn't know how to do her hair in a one-bedroom hotel room. And my husband was wearing a team uniform with a man from Al-Anon, and he was the son of my coach's team. And one more time, I felt the fear that they talk about in this book.
because I did not know what the hell was wrong with me, and the doctors kept giving me all these diagnoses and all these antidepressants and all these pills, but the damn thing is nothing was getting better. And I walked away from my family one more time, and there was a guy kicked back in front of a lounge chair with a big cooler in front of him, and I said, "Man, you look like you're feeling good." And he said, "Yeah, babe, nothing a beer wouldn't cure. You want one?" And I came to 3 days later, 45 minutes away from my home, where a woman found me when she was taking her trash out in a back alley, and I was somehow leaning up against the wall holding on to my backpack. They found my car at the Little League field, and to this day, 15 days later, I still absolutely do not remember any part of what happened in that 3 days, how I got so far away from my house, what happened to me. But I remember sitting in her kitchen, and I'm holding an ice pack on the side of my face because apparently I fell and grazed the whole side of my face. And she's holding my backpack and has my ID, and she's on the phone giving my husband, Rick, directions to yet come and pick me up one more time. And Rick came down to Inglewood, and he handed me a manila envelope. And he says, "Tammy, the kids and I have moved back into our home, and I'm not going to raise them out of a one-bedroom hotel room anymore. Your mother and I have legal custody of our two children, and you cannot come within 1,700 feet of me, of our home, of our children, of their school, or of my business. And, Tammy, you need to leave." And I didn't know what to say or do, and I didn't say a word the whole way home. And finally, he pulls up. It was a 45-minute ride, and we never said a word. And I just remember holding the envelope on my lap. And I remember he pulled up in front of the house, and he turned off the engine, and he said, "Tammy," he said, "your mom and I have called every Morgan hospital in the greater Los Angeles area these last 3 days. Those kids have been through hell and back. They are upstairs and they're finally asleep with the housekeeper. You have 5 minutes to pack up a few things, find a place to stay tonight, then find a permanent place to live, and I will have all your stuff sent to you, but don't you dare go near or wake up those kids." And he made me give him my word that I wouldn't do that, and I was done, and I just said, whatever. I knew I had to go. I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I could start to see now at 31 years old, I am destroying everybody's lives that I come into contact with. And I walked up the stairs to that house, and I remember just throwing some sweats and some t-shirts into a brown paper bag. And I'm thinking, who the heck can I call? And then I remembered my little AA bim boys that used to also hang out in the parking lot and flirt with me while the meeting was going on. And I'm 31 years old, married to a surgeon. I have a 2-year college degree, wonderful parents, a wonderful sister, and the only person in the world that I knew I could possibly get to come and pick me up that night were my little AA bim boys that used to hang out at the clubhouse and not go to meetings, just like me. And one of those guys agreed to come and pick me up. And I walked downstairs and I asked my husband, "I know I need to go. I want to go. But could I please just look in and say goodbye to my kids before I leave? I promise I won't wake him." And he said, "Tammy, don't you dare wake those children." And I walked into my little 5-year-old son Alex's room that night. And my little boy looked so little to me. He was in this big pine bunk bed, and his little head was like about this big. And I reeked of alcohol. I had vomit in my hair. I'd been on a 3-day drunk. And I just walked in, and I looked at him in his bed, and something happened to me. And this is not some BS esoteric podium story of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember I just took my finger and I touched his lips while he slept. And it was like the first time, this kid is 5 years old, and it's the first time I realized, like, he's alive and he's my kid. And I am destroying his childhood, pining over my childhood that had been gone for 20 years. And as I touched him, he smelt the alcohol and he picked up his hand and he just said, "Mommy, why are you doing this to us?" And in that instant, I became willing to be willing to do what ever it took. I never, ever wanted to drink alcohol again. And I hit my son's floor that night, and I said 3 words that I personally believe every alcoholic needs to say in some form or another before they surrender to this sucker. Not for their mommy, not their daddy, not their sponsor, not their therapist, not their kids, not their husband. For themselves. And finally, alcohol had beat me into a state of reasonableness. My sponsor didn't beat me, not my mom, not my dad, alcohol. And I got on my son's floor and I grabbed my arms and I said those 3 words. And I did say to a God I didn't even believe in, I said, "God, please help me." and something happened to me, and I felt a warmth come into my body, and all of a sudden I heard it like a megaphone on my son's floor, what I must have been hearing the 5 months that I had come flitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous, taking my chips, making a mockery of myself, and flirting with you men. Rarely do we see a person fail who thoroughly follows our path. And I realized that night on my son's floor that those old timers had responsibly carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to a drinking alcoholic, and I didn't even know that that's what they'd been doing in those 5 months, and I was done. And I slept in the back of my home group that night with barf in my hair, reeking of alcohol, in a broken down van that this guy used to keep for wet drunks who needed a place to stay. And here I am, a surgeon's wife, in a 5-bedroom house with a full-time maid. And I'm sleeping in a van in the back of my home, this guy with barf, the back of my home group with barf in my hair. And I don't think I ever have felt more at peace than I did that night. Because I was finished. I was not going to quit drinking one more time. I never, ever wanted to drink again. And I was willing to be willing to do whatever it took. I went in the next morning and I surrendered my right to drink alcohol to that mean old timer Nick, to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to God, and I have not had a drink since. You know, I wish I could tell you that I was a rocket to stardom in Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, we have all these little rules around here. You know, you have to get a sponsor, and you have to work the steps within the first 3 years, and, you know, the men work with the men, and the women work with the women, and I don't know, I was so beaten down from alcohol, I just came, and I just sat next to that old-timer Nick, and I never left his side. I didn't even begin to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous until I had 8 months of sobriety because I was so broken down. I didn't even notice gender. I didn't care if you were a man or a woman. If you were in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you were sober, I hung on to every single word that you shared because I never wanted to drink alcohol again. At 4 months of sobriety through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I received custody back of my 2 children. I received supervised custody of my kids. And through the grace of God and Al-Anon, my husband decided to give me a shot at a sober mother because I had gone 4 months sober, and he moved back into the house with the kids. And I got a chance to raise my kids sober, and I almost missed it all. And Alcoholics Anonymous was there that day in court. That old-timer Nick came with me to court the day that I received custody back of my kids. And they've been with me every step of the way. You know, I don't come from college-educated kind of folk, but I have a 21-year-old daughter that's at UCLA, and I have a 20-year-old son that's at Pierce College, and my daughter can take 17 units and make straight A's, and it's not a swearing off. And then there's my boy Alex, who signs up for 17 units and then drops 11, and I pay the tuition and the books, and he is definitely one of us. And I went back to school after a year of sobriety, and I went in and I said, Nick, I signed up for 17 units. And he said, good kid, now you're going to go drop 11 of them, because those old-timers told me that I don't schedule my meetings around my busy little life, that my entire life is to be scheduled around my participation in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ended up finishing up my bachelor's degree 6 units at a time. I've been sober 15 years, and two and a half years ago, I finished my master's degree. And we don't come from college-educated kind of folk. And they told me that great events would come to pass for me and countless others. And my kids are in college. I received a college today. And even though I lost my legal right to raise the 2 children that I gave birth to because of the power of a liquid called vodka, a clear liquid that looked like vodka was so powerful, it became more powerful than a love a mother had for her own 2 children. And today, not only did I get a chance to raise my children and receive custody of them when they were 5 and 6. But today I teach your kids. I'm a 6th grade school teacher at a local public school. If that doesn't scare you, it certainly should. And that's all through the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, last I want to share that it wasn't all a happy ending. At 11 and a half years of sobriety, my husband came home and told me he was leaving me for another woman. And when I finally became a sober mom, I became like the PTA mom and the Little League mom, and I was going to be the perfect wife, and I ran my husband's office and kept the house clean and went to meetings and did this and did that because I was so higher powered and so excited. And at 11 and a half years, he left me for another woman, and he told me, she's prettier than you, she's younger than you, and she's more fun than you.
and I thought I was going to die. And my beautiful little son that was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings from the time he was 5 years old, at 15 fell so hard to addiction that after two hospitals, a lockdown unit, and a wilderness camp, I had to have him kidnapped in the middle of the night and taken away to Utah for a year to be put in a lockdown facility to save his life. And 2 months after that, my old-timer, who had walked me through Alcoholics Anonymous the first 11 years of my sobriety, took me through the steps and the traditions and was a one-on-one mentor to me, died of a stroke. And in 3 months at 11 and a half years sober, I lost my three best guys. I lost my husband, my son, and my old-timer. And I wish I could tell you that I had that what they call money in the bank. I went to a meeting every day. I read this book. I worked with women. I spoke. I participated. I did all the service work. And at 11 and a half years sober, I went up to bed, I turned the heating blanket on to Mom, I sucked my thumb, and I was pounding my head thinking of ways to kill myself. And all the girls that I work with, my newcomer friends, would say, Tammy, you're a pretty woman, you didn't deserve this, you're a victim, poor you, poor you. And then came the old-timers. And thank God that I had been a regular attending, participating member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that 11 and a half years, because my seat was only vacant a couple of weeks, and they immediately noticed that I was not there. And these old-timers came out, and they got me, and this time it was my friend Patrick. And Patrick had seen me come in 15 years earlier, and he said, Tammy, something's not adding up. You're not at meetings. I don't see you around. What's going on? And I told Patrick the truth about what was going on. You don't understand. My husband's left me for another woman. I have a drug-addicted kid, and my old-timer died, and my whole life's a wreck. And he told me that. Butt kick of the newcomer. He says, Tammy, you are not the first damn woman that's been left in AA, and you're not going to be the last. He said, you are also not the first woman that has a drug-addicted child, nor will you be the last. And for God's sakes, you know how many of us have buried our old-timers, and you're not going to be the last. Now get up out of this damn bed, quit sucking your thumb, and do what that old-timer taught you to do for the last 11 years, and carry the message of hope to a newcomer. And one more time, he told me the truth about me, because my problem is alcoholism. My problem is not me. If my problem is me, if you take an equation, Tammy plus alcohol, it was a disaster for my children. Tammy plus alcohol, it was a disaster for my husband. Tammy plus alcohol, it was a disaster for you in society. I was a drunk driver. Tammy plus alcohol, I could not keep a job and lived off state aid. But by removing alcohol, not removing Tammy, but by removing alcohol and replacing it with the program as outlined in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the outcome has been Tammy plus the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship has worked out well for my children. Tammy plus the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a calm, non-chaotic, loving, peaceful relationship. Tammy plus the program outlined in this book, I get to help kids today. And I've even won awards as a teacher, and I couldn't even raise my own kids because the problem is alcohol. I'm an alcoholic. I can never give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what you've given me, but I'm going to go down trying. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, when I feel the fear that they talk about in this book, I have a mighty powerful God that I can pray to for strength. And when I feel the fear that I talk about in this book, I have friends that I can call and talk those dumb fears through with. I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, and more importantly, I thank each and every one of you in Alcoholics Anonymous for God. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy.